Well, folks, it's my great pleasure to welcome again, only this time into the studio, all the panelists for another edition of Valley Edition. I want to welcome Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike. Great to be here with a full studio.
All right. And Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be here with everybody.
And Terry Snyder, all the way from Juneau.
I made it back.
It's wonderful to have you here. Well, we have a number of things that have happened both, at all levels. This past week on the national level, we've had a speech to the Congress by the president. We've had activities continuing on in Juneau, and we've had a couple of meetings here in the borough. We've had one on Tuesday that involved the city council, and we also had a school board meeting on Wednesday. So let's start out with the biggest news, the one we really want to talk about. And we've had a meeting in Anchorage, Fisheries Group, with some very maybe disturbing news for the Valley. But I want to start with the biggest news of all. Fred Meyer's opened a new store.
Have you been there? It's Friday morning, so it just opened, 3 hours ago?
8 o'clock. Oh, it just opened today.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's mobbed already.
We reported at 7:30 in the morning. We sent one of our ace reporters over, and Lee was over there. I was stuck here in the studio, and she interviewed some people, including Nate Wallace, who's the city manager. Was over there, and Lee was able to park on the edge of the parking lot since it was full. And she walked in, and she posted a picture which I think conveys the scene, basically, which is a panorama of the hundreds of people that were lined up to enter through the door at 8 a.m.
And there was a function, I believe, right? At 7:45, there was not a grand opening type.
And there were giveaways.
Yes.
But the other interesting thing about that was that inside the store, that ribbon cutting and celebration was not for the people standing outside. It was for the internal employees, longtime employees of Fred Meyer's. Okay. And then once that was taken care of, then the doors opened, people went in, and you received certificates, and you also received, I happened to talk to someone, my daughter, who said, as I approached her in the coffee house, yes, I was at Fred Meyer's, and she pointed out she had the bacon, the eggs, and the bread that were given away.
Oh, free samples.
First 300.
Oh, free breakfast. I'm excited about free samples.
And the certificates, et cetera. So people were obviously interested. I checked to see, how would you describe the people that were in the line
at 8 in the morning on a work day.
I think it's safe to use the words of the city manager. It was a cross section of Palmer. There were all kinds of different people there. Some
big event,
and some people had been there for hours waiting.
And it's windy and hateful.
And it's
cold, awful here in Palmer today.
And it was
it's awful. As
the
Palmer
window
can be.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is that the focus of attention was a new store, big store, and those people have reported on the interior, said, yes, it's big inside and it's big outside. But I think kicking off with that is to point out that this is a, given Palmer's setup with the variety of stores we have, this is a big change. Perhaps in some other place, if you were in Anchorage or maybe even in Wasilla, it would not be. But here in Palmer, having this opening this way is pretty significant. We've reported in the past that Fred Meyer had employed a large number of additional employees for the store. They're up just under 300 employees, and that's a major effort. And, of course, in addition, the facility sits within the city of Palmer, and so that means the 3% tax applies and will have some impact upon the city's bottom line. So
does the extra space go to new products, or is it just more of all the usual stuff?
Well, there have been departments reportedly that are bigger, sporting goods.
Yes.
Yeah.
So plus clothing. I mean, the Wasilla Fred Meyer and the Palmer Fred Meyer.
Not as much as Wasilla, but at least more than the variety they had.
Yeah.
And my understanding, and I have only the words of other people, observations of other people, is that yes, this is going to be a significant improvement or enlargement, if you will, over what has been in Palmer. Will it have all of the features that Wasilla has? I'm not sure. I don't think quite. Mm-hmm. But it's seemingly attracting people.
Well, it also begs the question, what happens to the one building that they're vacating?
Right.
Because that's always bad to have. I mean, if we kind of roll back a little bit, you had, you know, Big Cars opening a few years ago when they opened right across the street from where the present Fred Meyer is. Then you had an empty building for many, many years that sat vacant, which
and
doesn't
then
look
good. And Fred Meyer raised it to build
right,
a new
to build a new one. But now they've left the several thousand square feet, which is still their property, open. So not going to be another grocery store. We pretty much know that. But what will happen to that is kind of key. And
has there been any talk of that?
Oh, much talk.
Lots of talk. So much.
All speculation or?
Mostly, yeah.
So we each week ask that question, and apparently the asking price for the building is reasonably high. You can check it out. It's listed even in Seattle and so on. And no one has come forward with the idea that we'll change that. And, of course, the other question that remains around the location is that Cars in the large store there and the new Fred Meyer sit across the street from one another, but they're also on the other side of the Glen Highway. Mm-hmm. And although if you're in a vehicle, yes, and depending on where you're coming from, access is pretty easy, it changes something of the dynamic many people have pointed to, because in the summer in particular, there are many people that walk about town or combine a trip to the post office with a trip to the store. And this will make it a bit different. We'll just see what happens as time plays out. Mark, do you have any to comment? Okay.
I know, just interestingly enough, I was in Juneau. I heard while I was there that the Walmart building that was vacated, it's been vacant about a year or so, right, in Juneau, has now been bought by investors. Nobody's quite sure what it's going to be.
And it marijuana was something, cultivation
it was,
facility.
Yeah, really. Mm. So it was something before it was what it is, Walmart. But it'd be interesting to see who ends up taking Palmer. So somebody is still buying those big buildings.
Beer making.
When did Walmart pull out of Juneau?
Oh, a year and a half ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's one of the stores that they closed. So it sits out there in the valley quite empty.
Mm-hmm. So another significant event that happened, and I'll finish up with the Palmer City Council, was a discussion of the ongoing controversy involving a planned unit development just south of the Palmer Junior Middle School. And that has been probably ongoing for about 2 years. There's been a pushback from another development that sits right next door to it. And at the Palmer City Council meeting, Jack Snodgrass, a formerly longtime attorney for the city, spoke and made some suggestions about the way in which the process had determined that this would go forward. And the suggestion, I think, in part, was to move it back to be reviewed more by the Planning Commission. And I checked again today to see the status of this whole thing. And there was an executive session at the Palmer City Council meeting. And basically, the Planning Commission for the city moved this forward, made some recommendations for changes. It was appealed by nearby residents. It passed the appeal, and it is now a lawsuit, which is in the courts. And there is no thought that, no matter what happens with the suit, that this construction would begin this summer. It's going to be a while. So we'll see how it plays out. But it certainly is occupying the attention of a number of people, both within the city as well as neighbors, about a topic that I think we're going to come back to again.
And so, Mike, is the issue with the density of the development?
There are two terms I have learned. The one I understood, I thought, density. And that would suggest that if you have a given piece of land, how many how many buildings are you putting on there and how much green space is going to be in between. But the second term was one that I had to research, talk to people about, and that it was mentioned at the meeting, and that's intensity. So if you want to get a good model, I think I have this right to say, so if I put one building on there, but it happens to be 24 stories tall, so it has 100 units in it, that's a pretty intense use of that. So it could look like the one building has got a small footprint, a lot of green space, but you still have an intense development. Density refers to how you occupy the variety of places on that piece of property. And so that was raised as a question that in both terms of density and intensity, this felt like there was perhaps, these are my terms, a need to have a certain number of units to pencil it out. You had only this amount of land to deal with. So there we are.
Yeah, I haven't followed it that closely, but I know there was some angst about the fact that some of it was going to be low-cost housing, subsidized housing.
I thought that that was part of it, too.
Yeah, and so it's not just,
God forbid.
And that may be part of the issue. It would almost appear that if you started, though, on the basis of, let's take away the idea of whether it's low-cost or high-cost.
Well, that's the one, yeah.
And start with the question, does this meet the criteria for good development, whatever that means, in terms of intensity and density? Then move on to the other issues. Perhaps that's a way to do it, although, yes, I've heard the same thing, a lot of passion around the question of who's going to be in there. But I'll just give you an update. Basically, it looks like it's going to be a while. The other topic that was mentioned there, and, of course, it's been discussed at other meetings at the borough level, and that happens to be the issue of moving the dispatch center. And it looks as if the update there is that if everything goes well, that somewhere in the middle of this year, perhaps in July or thereabouts, if you dial 911, you'll still get the proper response, but it will no longer be happening necessarily out of the dispatch center here unless you're going to have a response from the local Palmer Fire or Police Department, because basically dispatch will be handled for those two entities out of the dispatch here, while the rest of the borough will be handled with the exception of the troopers, which are handled under a separate contract, also, though, over in Wasilla.
Well, I'm glad they straightened that out.
Yes, well, the plan is there. The pieces are in place. They're moving in that direction. And it's a question of implementation and how successful making all this happen will be in the given time. So, but at least at this point, it's still on its way. It's still happening. Okay?
Is anybody throwing down hurdles or expressing, concerns about usefulness of it?
Well, I think the focus presently, at least what I have heard, is more about is this a realistic timeline for implementation? I think we're beyond the point of should we or shouldn't we do this. The commitment has been made. It's going to happen. Can we do it in the proper time? And then afterwards, there'll be an opportunity to review and see, is this all working well? So let's shift to a couple of other topics, areas. I know I want to have Terry talk a little bit about her experience. She's just been in a place where
time stands still.
Oh, it must have been wonderful. A Zen moment, quiet, meditative, all the rest of it. Is that your general summary of what's happening in Juneau at the moment, or?
Well, there are things happening, definitely. About half the session is over. In fact, yesterday marked half the session, although I don't think anybody in that building is optimistic they will be done on time. The normal thought is that they won't quite have the session after sessions, but that they may run past their 90 days into the hundreds days. The House Finance is working pretty darn hard on their bills, that's for sure. I will say, I was really, really happy to see the smoke-free workplace bill, SB 63, get out of Senate Health and Social Services in one day.
Wow.
Headed to finance. So hopefully then it'll proceed to the floor. So some of that stuff is getting through. I talked to personally probably 15, 20 legislators had meetings with. Probably we met with the last about half of them. You know, budget is number one. Everybody's has a different way of putting it. There was a lot of questions about should we use the permanent fund. You know, there was a lot of angst about school funding, I'd say. There seems to be hopefully a consensus that, you know, that while everybody's ox is going to get gored in some way, that maybe some of those that were gored before won't get gored as bad. And, you know, hopefully that means the seniors and the most vulnerable of us. But there really is not a solution. And what's a little scary to me is that they won't find one this year because they are so far apart. And there is some palatable bitterness in the House side of the new minority that has been the majority for a long time. And, you know, particularly I know for a couple of the members saying it's a good thing we have those friends of ours in the Senate to straighten things out here because this is not a done deal. So it seems that they're still struggling for answers and how they're going to do this in conference committee without just delaying it because everybody's just wrung out and tired of fighting about it. I don't know how they're going to do that this year, which I don't think is good news to Alaskans at all because another year of certainty is going to mean more uncertainty is going to mean more jobs gone. There's still the same sort of people are still dug into the fact that we have to cut more, even though they're very unclear about what needs to be cut. There are some realists in the room. I'd say there's pretty much an overall consensus other than a few that the permanent fund has to be some way restructured.
Well, I know there was talk early on in the session about, you know, solving that piece and putting everything else on hold. Yeah. Is that, were you still hearing anything
well,
like that?
Well, I think that's what the Senate would like to do a little bit. They've rolled out their bill and they don't really want to talk about the cuts. But I think the rationale is that you need to have both. We have to know how you're going to restructure it. So you have to know where the give and take, what we're paying for. And so it's not really, you know, fair to the public to say we're going to restructure the permanent fund without having a plan for what that money is going to go towards. And if you're not ready to talk about that, it's not the complete conversation.
Do you think there's any hope in the minority that there could be a restructuring next year for the second half of the session?
I think that's the
delay?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly, I think, that feeling in the building of people that don't find the urgency. There's no election this year. They still want to hear from the public, which kind of shocks me because it seems to me that everybody's told them. I mean, and there's some pretty strong feelings on it. But I don't know. You know, it's the same people are going to hold the same line in thinking we'll never need an income tax and that government is always too big. There's one bill I was looking at that Dunleavy, it's actually a state affairs bill that Senate has put out called SJR2, I think. That the American Prosperity people are touting around. And that's like the Tabor in Colorado, which is, you ever talk to anybody in Colorado that has the Tabor, it's a revenue cap that has just absolutely brought their public school system to their knees. And it's been horrible, horrible, horrible for them.
Didn't that affect marijuana?
Yeah, they had to give tons and tons of money back. So it means it's a really bad cycle where even though when the state is doing really, really well, they can't fix anything. They can't put it towards any projects because it's a revenue cap. They can't keep the money to improve their school system or improve their roads or anything. So that one's being touted about. It hasn't gotten too much legs yet, but I have a feeling we're going to see that one, and that could have some really dire consequences to across the board. So, on the bright side, there's some fresh eyes down there, some new freshmen that are not exactly happy to play by the rules of the old guard, which is kind of nice to see, which is, you know, their staff has moved around a lot of moves around in staff. So it was a little different than I anticipated it to be. Not exactly the hangover that you get on the second session, a little more bright eye and bushy tails going on down there. But that'll wane because you still have to find answers. And they're not really hearing a lot of bills yet, but they're hearing from a lot of people, I mean, they're getting groups through there. Not a lot of individual constituents, but they're getting a lot of group there. The university, so we'll see what happens. I mean, like I said, some things change, some things never change. But I just don't know how they can find consensus. They're so far apart in the two bodies to find consensus.
Well, it seems
and maybe
to
that's
me,
why the governor's staying out of it at this point.
And I think there could be a dose of maybe that's why the Senate's digging in, especially Dunleavy. If he's going to run for governor, it would seem to work into his playbook to have things not fixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then he can blame the governor and say, here's the plan I have. Did you hear any other chatter down there about folks who might be challenging the governor?
Oh, you know, if you listen to the chatter, half the Senate's challenging him. I think that's been pretty much it. Not any more than I heard up here, really. They're definitely, he's got a target on his back. There's no two ways about it. But, you know, there's also some seats that might be in question if they don't do their jobs this year. Some really closely, one race is on the House side that, you know, were pretty darn close. I mean, we turned over a few seats, but we also had a couple of really close elections. And we're just going to have to see how much tolerance the public has for them not doing their job again. And there's a lot of people that have that pretty strong sentiment that people are kind of tired of not having answers. So we'll see. You know, they had a HB 115, which is the Finance Committee's bill on what to do about the fiscal crisis, a small income tax, adjusting the permanent fund and some other things. Didn't get many call-ins yesterday. I didn't hear. I listened to both. There was quite a long span of time that they were to hear, and I heard the calls weren't very robust. So, you know, it's a really complicated, it's a math problem with some very tough moral consequences. And I think that the public is starting to feel the pain of it, but they just don't understand the math of it. It's really hard for the normal person to understand. What I'm not hearing about too much, and I don't think we'll get dealt with this year, is any adjustment in the oil taxes. That one is just too much to try to think of restructuring the permanent fund and to figure out the math on that and also the oil taxes. You're just not, I mean, they're having hearings on it and such, but I just can't imagine, unless they just move it a little bit to say, hey, we did something.
So I know that what happened this week was there was a little bit of discussion about reducing the per diem rate for legislators. Any talk at all about that? That just had it popped up and sort of disappeared. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
nope.
Things seem to be moving along, but perhaps slowly. There's another natural formation that in the past has moved very slowly. We're talking about glaciers. Zaz?
That was very smooth, Mike.
Thank you. What do you have to say?
So speaking of glaciers, so I am finishing up a story on Matanuska Glacier, which is the largest glacier maybe in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly in Alaska, that you can drive and walk to. So it's sort of the most user-friendly glacier. I mean, Kinnick, you can get there, but it's a haul on a four-wheeler or a horse or on foot or plane. I mean, there's lots of fly-in glaciers, but if you don't have flight access, is small.
I think
this
you can still get to Mendenhall. Yeah, you can get to Mendenhall, but you have to hike in.
It's a hike in.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is
most accessible.
Easier to get to, but it's also privately owned at its toe. And so there's been for decades a company that basically has authority over access and how much you pay to get there. Matanuska Glacier Park, LLC. And this was a homestead originally, and they own the road in and a parking area. It turns out Siri owns most of the land, the actual ice and the terminal moraine between the parking lot and the glacier. But that's of interest because Matanuska Glacier Park has, in November, changed its policy. And if you are a first-time visitor without outdoor travel experience, you are going to pay for a $100 tour, whether you want to or not.
Wow.
And they're still figuring out their year-round, their summer policy, which is when they get the bulk of their visitors, a couple hundred visitors a day. And these are independent visitors to the glacier. These aren't people who sign up for tours from somebody else and show up.
It's the largest amount of our tourists tourism to our state or individual.
And a lot of state and Mattsu Borough tourism agencies point people toward the Mat Glacier because, it's, I mean, it's exceptional. It really is a world-class chunk of ice. It's remarkable to walk around on there. You at least are paying $25 a person if you're an Alaskan to get past the gate and walk around unsupervised. But even in summer, it sounds like unless you can document that you have as yet to be determined outdoor experience, it's a very vague process right now. How do you tell?
Right. I've been there a half
why
a dozen
do you,
times.
Why do you have to have that?
How do I show that I have been? Do I have pictures I have to show of me having been there in 19-whatever?
What's the rationale for that? Liability?
It's not liability per se. I think it is reputation. There are more people visiting the glacier, and so with more people comes more risk of people doing something that's going to get them hurt or killed, which hasn't happened yet, which is amazing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, walking around on a glacier like that, I mean, and because this is such a deep glacier, even at its toe, I mean, there was a Knowles trip, this was years ago, I think 89,
right. Remember
where
that.
A 17-year-old was lost in a moulin, one of those tunnels. They never found him, ever. Mm. So there are obviously there are hazards there, and you know the more people that come from places where there aren't glaciers or trails, the more trouble they could get into. It's a private business, and private businesses tend to like to generate revenue. So you know, obviously there's a rationale there. I mean, it's possible that this may backfire, that you'll get enough people driving all the way out there and saying, $500 for my family of five to walk, and I'm not doing that. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But right now, the policy is not in writing. They're still working out what it's going to actually say. But yeah, I wouldn't mind standing in their little visitor center, information office, tour shop, gift shop, and watching as they, yes, you can go without a tour guide. No, you all can't. I'm not sure how, and I talked with the caretaker, Bill Stevenson, fairly extensively, but how are you going to do this exactly? And how are you going to deal with the animosity and the results, you know?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
But it's a fascinating, I think it's just a fascinating story because, you know, you could argue, and some do, that this is a public resource. It's such a big glacier. Anywhere else would be a national park. But it's not. It's
privately
owned.
But interestingly enough, you said that the glacier itself.
Yes.
Is owned by Siri.
Yep. And but, that's a whole, that's
so how
yet to be resolved for years.
That's been an issue. And there, I'm guessing, would be a discussion about, well, if you're going to do that, then are you going to pay for
Are you going to trespass
our,
at this point?
Our glacier,
And I think until now, there haven't been that many people out there. But now more people are out there. And there's this new policy where this, you know, private business is asking people to pay more. I think now Siri is saying, okay, we've let this slide, but no more. You know, this has gotten too big.
Interesting.
Wonderful. Wonderful story. Well.
Fish wars?
Fish wars. I think the only thing we can say now is the first reports that are coming out, there haven't been a lot of smiles on the part of the people from the borough.
No, dire press releases coming from that borough.
Oh, really?
Okay.
There was an amendment yesterday that didn't go well.
But we will have to discuss this once we actually get the details so we can discuss it intelligently in our next edition of Valley Edition. For this, I'm going to thank Terry Snyder.
Have a good weekend.
Saz Hollander.
Thanks, Mike.
And Mark Kelsey.
See y'all next week.
All right. So we are done with this edition of Valley Edition. Look forward to another edition next week. Thank you all.